people involved there to work with both in the Rossport campaign, the protest activity, defeating service charge collection taxes, and waiting for possibly remember when I'm nervous. So, as you're here for a very short amount of time, we decided that best use we do is to focus on a couple of questions that we've been interested in asking. But if you've got questions you want to ask us, do that as well.
Oh, come on, let's go.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Sorry, I have to use a brush. Thanks, Dave.
Sure, I've heard the talking this
morning. No, it's okay. That's a possible place. This is a relaxing general experience.
All right, so John has got the first question. Where is he?
I'm just wondering, Adam is a pretty small political tendency in the world today. I'm just wondering, what do you think, relevancy, or what role do you see it playing in the future in a school of greater kind of world?
I actually don't think that anarchism is a small tendency. I mean, what's called anarchism is a small tendency, but it's a very natural understanding of most people. You know, I'm sure you find this in your own organizing work. When you talk about anarchist principles, they resonate with most people because it's basically their own conception of the world. I mean, the feeling that you ought to be dominated by someone is not a natural human feeling. So if there are, and everyone's faced with them all the time, structures of domination and control, most people don't like them. Okay, it's anarchism. If you don't like systems of domination and control, you should do things to dismantle them. That's basic anarchist principle. It's very deeply embedded in people. You really have to work really hard to drive it out of people's heads. There's enormous efforts to drive these normal sentiments out of people's heads, but they're never far below the surface, which is why they always well up all over the town whenever there's a any kind of confrontation or break or opportunity to think about things, they just emerge. I think anarchists have about the easiest organizing task of anybody. They're mostly common sense.
Okay, Dermot, who interrupted you yesterday.
Sorry about that.
He got very excited.
Yeah.
He's got a second chance to
do it. I hope it's not your last tour, just a busy schedule and all that. But it's great to see you. First thing I'd like to say is welcome to the North Side. It's great to have you over here. The second thing I wanted to say was, one of the first things that you wrote about was the Spanish Revolution in 1936. This year being 2006, it would be the 70th anniversary. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the relevance of that? Or does it have any relevance today?
I actually did write about that at the advanced age of 10 years old. But fortunately, it's not preserved. I was pretty much interested in it from a child's point of view. I was hanging around, a couple of years later, I was hanging around anarchist offices in New York and picking up literature, talking to refugees, plenty of refugees who came over to the United States. They were running little secondhand bookstores and so on. Very happy to see some young person around. But it was a pretty amazing event. I mean, there was, and it has tremendous relevance, I think. It's the peak of anti-authoritarian activism and success in history. You know, there's been nothing like it, certainly in the modern world. And it was so important that it immediately elicited the joint attack by every force in the world. I mean, fascists, Stalinists, liberal democracies, and they all got together at once to crush it, because this was much too dangerous to tolerate. And it was only after they had succeeded in crushing the revolution that they sort of went to pick up the pieces and fight each other, more or less. But there was a popular libertarian revolution. There's a lot to learn from it. It was not spontaneous. It had been developed for 50 years of intensive organizing, experimentation, schools, revolts, which partially succeeded, crushed, but it left a memory, people go on. It was just in people's heads. So when the moment came, people just carried. done different ways in industrial areas in Catalonia, the peasant areas in Asturias and so on, that developed very rapidly. Complex, you know, was a lot of things to be criticized. Interesting, good proposals as to how to win the war, which have been mostly suppressed by now, but the sensible idea as to how to fight Franco was coming from anarchists, in particular from Camillo Ranieri, who was killed in the May Days, an Italian anarchist who had joined. His, you know, it might not have worked, but he had the right idea, and it's an idea that's very pertinent to the world since, and if, you know, not in the ways of knowing it, but these things are so obvious to people that they keep coming back, you know, without any history. But his idea, which is highly pertinent, was that they should not fight a military war against Franco. It's not going to work. They should fight to the extent that there's any fighting, it should be a guerrilla war, which is very natural in Spain. That's where the concept of guerrilla war developed in the Napoleonic Wars. And again, it's in people's heads. And the main thing that they should do is undercut the roots of the Franco army. The Franco army was a Moorish army that was coming from Morocco, and his sensible proposal was, you don't fight them, you cause them to collapse. And you cause them to collapse by dealing with their problems. I mean, the people in the Franco army are just as oppressed as you are. You know, they're not some kind of beasts. They're Moroccans who were enlisted into the essentially foreign legion. It's the same Spanish legion, incidentally, which today, speaking of relevance, it's the same Spanish Legion, which in the last few days has its commander announced that they're going to march on Madrid to prevent devolution in Spain or rights to Catalonia. So that's, you know, today's headline. Same Legion, you know, same commander, you know, not same people, same kind of commanders. And the suggestion then, which applies now too, is to undercut their base by supporting the revolutionary movements in North Africa. They were there. You know, there were Abdelkrim was organizing a revolutionary movement to try to, you know, call for land, for freedom, ridding themselves of French and Spanish imperialism. And Bernieri's proposal was, well, okay, let's support them. If we support them instead of fighting them, we're, you know, they join us. They want land. They don't want French boots on their necks. So sure, let's all get together and fight the same war against the combined leadership on all sides. Now, of course, that would have utterly infuriated France and Britain and the United States, who would totally berserk. But you know, if you had a choice at that point, shall we cater to the imperial powers and let them carve us up and, you know, smash us and so on? Or shall we just fight a people's war against them? You know, could have all worked. I mean, it could have held off the Second World War, you know, because of the changes that might have taken place. But those are issues which are by no means dead. Like I say, park on the front pages right now, and they show up both in terms of struggles against imperialism in different forms, but the same principles, and also just the tremendous success in collectivization and building a society without, you know, hierarchy and so on. One of the best descriptions of it, although he didn't understand what was going on, is George Orwell. He had really no idea what was going on, but he was writing from the point of view of the Prüm militia, you know, kind of semi-Trotskyite militia, and that's what he saw. So he didn't understand the anarchists at all, didn't know anything about them. But he gave a very vivid portrayal of what it was like. See, he'd never seen anything like that. You know, go through Barcelona, nobody's calling anyone sir, you know, people are comrades, there's no hierarchy, people are participating. So I don't understand what it was, you know, a lot of things I don't like, but it's something you just have to appreciate. You know. Came back a couple months later, and he said, it's totally different. You know, you're back to the bowing and scraping, the orders of Stalinist communist leadership had taken over, crushed the revolution, was in the process of crushing the revolution with the support of the West and the support of Franco. But but that's, you know, even from his skewed perspective, just as a perceptive human being, he saw something really important happening here. And if you read the documents on the collectivization, by now they're available. Actually, when I was writing about it, this long time ago, I had to use the original documents, which I picked up in the bookstores around 1940. But by now they're all available. And it's a cross scholarship. The original documents are out. You can really learn quite a lot about it. And yeah, it's an inspiring experience, I think, with lots of lessons.
Okay, Ushi.
You said before that the class war is occurring, but that not everyone seems to be aware of that fact. Just a question that I want to ask is, what do you think the significance and the relevance of class analysis is for libertarian social politics?
Yeah, remains of continuing relevance. There are class differences that are important. Part of the strength of the anarchist tradition is to recognize that that's only some of the forms of hierarchy and domination. There's plenty of others, but they're crucially significant. Struggling in Ireland all the time, everywhere else. Recent strikes are an example. I mean, class war always goes on. I mean, there's one class that relentlessly fights class war, the business classes. They never relent for a minute. So they're always fighting a vicious class war. They want everybody else to pretend it doesn't exist. But, you know, for them, it's a permanent war. Any attempt to, and the whole doctrinal system, schools, media, and so on, tries to prevent people from seeing it. They kind of, we're all in it together, you know, harmony, this and that. But what's the business world doing? And business and government are so closely connected, you can barely distinguish them. But business, government, educational hierarchies, you know, they're always fighting the class war. I mean, every time you look at an advertisement on television, it's class war. It's trying to turn you into a passive consumer. So you won't talk to other people and, you know, try to figure out something wrong with all of these things. There's not a moment when you're not engaged in class war. You can decide, you know, you can succumb without going to notice it. But it's hitting you every minute of the day down to infants. I mean, when I watch television with my grandchildren, you know, 3-year-old kids, just take a look at what's being presented to them on television. I mean, they're being deeply indoctrinated into passivity, conformism, consumerism, rejection of conflict, failing. You know, this is just a class war, a constant class war, never stops. So sure, class analysis is important. It's not the only thing that's going on. It's a major part.
Toby.
I have been part in dissent in politics and speaking at events like this since the American invasion of South Vietnam. How have you noticed the change in the reception of yourself and your ideas?
Well, when I started speaking about the invasion of South Vietnam, for one thing, you couldn't use the phrase. There was years. I mean, in an educated audience, you still can't use the phrase. Like I was talking at Harvard Graduate School, you know, couldn't use the words, it would be like talking to Sumerian or something. Because the words don't exist. I mean, have you ever seen it in a newspaper or a scholarly work or anything? I mean, there's no such thing except in the real world. Yes, there was such a thing. So first of all, you couldn't talk about it. Furthermore, the audiences were 3 or 4 people in somebody's living room. Or occasionally be a church where there'd be 4 people there. You know, the pastor who kindly gave us the church, the organizer, drunk who walked in, some other guy who wanted to murder me. That was a typical audience. When the anti-war movement began in the early 60s, even close to the mid, like 1964, you know, that late, if we wanted to have a meeting somewhere, say a college, we'd have to bring together, you know, 6 topics, you know, Iran, Venezuela, you know, Brazil, Vietnam, you know, then maybe get 10 people to come out because they're interested in different things. In fact, the first pub, Boston, where I live, is the most city in the country. It's, they like to call themselves the Athens of America, Harvard, all this kind of stuff. But it's the center of American liberalism. I mean, the first public meeting against the war was the International Days of Solidarity Against the War. It was October 15th, 1965. And there were demonstrations all around the world. So we figured, okay, we'll try to have an outdoor demonstration in Boston. There hadn't been one before on any scale. And there's a place in Boston, it's Boston Common, which is like the Free Speech area, sort of Hyde Park. So there was a march down to Boston Common, a couple of speakers. I was supposed to be one of the speakers. So, big mobs of counter-demonstrators, mostly coming from universities, there to break up the demonstration. Couldn't get a word out. Nobody could be heard. In fact, the only reason we weren't slaughtered was there were a couple hundred state cops around who didn't like what we were saying, but didn't want to see people murdered on the Boston Common. The next day, in the newspapers, take a look at the Boston Globe, the most liberal newspaper in the country. The front page, entire front page was devoted to this, and the big picture in the front of a wounded soldier. You know, here's a soldier fighting for freedom, and the rest of it was all about these county rats trying to undermine our brave soldiers, you know, that kind of stuff. The radio was full of it, you know, just denunciations. If you go to Congress, the people who later pretended to be, after the war went sour, everybody suddenly became a long time secret dove, you know, really secret. But then they had a memoir, Kennedy memoir, so rewrote their memoirs and so on. I got a new story. But people like, you know, the people who later became celebrated as anti-war heroes, Mike Mansfield and others, were denouncing what they called the irresponsibility of the protesters. And in a way, they were right, because the protests were so mild, it was embarrassing. This was literally embarrassing to say the words. This was 4 years after Kennedy had launched a major war against South Vietnam. And before that war, there were about 70,000 people had been killed by the U.S. client state. 61, 62 was when the major war started. It was all against the South. But in February 1965, that's when they started bombing the North, and that's what he could protest against, bombing the North. And the rest, most of the anti-war movement from that point on was against the bombing of the North. Well, you know, bombing of the North was an atrocity, but it didn't come close to what was going on in South Vietnam, not even close. You know. But that's kind of gone from history. And part of the reason is that the anti-war movement either didn't understand, which is partly largely true, or just couldn't pick it up. Well, that was February 1965. By that time, there were about 250,000 American troops in South Vietnam rampaging, and the country was almost gone. You know, I mean, it's been totally devastated. And so it went. By 1967 and 68, there was a substantial popular movement, you know, and tens of thousands of people, certainly. But still, the focus was mostly in Europe, too. The focus was on the bombing of the North. And there's a reason for that. It's not a pretty reason. The reason is that the attack on South Vietnam was costless for the United States. I mean, just the killing and massacring completely defenseless people. Nobody cares. When you bomb North Vietnam, it was more dangerous. For one thing, you're hitting Russian ships in the Haiphong Harbor. You're bombing a Chinese railroad. The way the French built railroads, the Chinese railroad, people in the South happened to go through North Vietnam. So you start bombing a Chinese railroad, well, the Chinese might react, the Russians might react. If you bomb anywhere near Hanoi, you're bombing European embassies. And they get upset. And furthermore, there are reporters up there, so they'll go, you know, 20 miles around Hanoi, and they see villages wiped out. Like it. So bombing the North carried costs, and therefore it was an issue. But bombing the South carried no costs. And it's striking when you read the declassified, you know, the Pentagon Papers are kind of like stolen archives. You get the real story, not Billy Goodwin. And therefore, they're almost ignored by scholarship and by the media, practically ignored. But they're very revealing. For example, one of the things they show is that the bombing of the North was planned in meticulous detail. You know, they really thought about it, how far should we go? The deal with bombing the South, it's not imagined. They just do whatever they feel like. You know? So there's barely any mention of planning. You want to target villages with B-52 bombing, fine, you do it, so forth. And the anti-war movement is responsible for this too, because they kept to the same framework of overwhelmingly. And that's the picture that lasts in history. So look at the history of the war, that's what it is. By the late 60s, things really had changed. And a lot of other things have changed too, because the anti-war movement just kind of integrated with a lot of other things that were going on. So you're barely beginning to get the beginnings of the feminist movement at that time. And the sources of it, I don't know what it's like here, but in the United States it was very striking to watch. Now, part of these sources of the women's movement were the sexism of the anti-war movement. Very striking. You can see it. Especially the draft resistors. I was working a lot with resistance. And the draft resistors were brave people. You know, 17, 18-year-old kids who are facing real problem, not fun to spend years in jail, go to exile, never get back home. And they felt righteous, you know. And part of the way you felt righteous was by oppressing young women, who then sort of supposed to serve you and admire you and so on. And the women, after a while, started to resent because the general typical anarchist sentiments of not being want to be kicked around were coming up. And that led to critique of the sexism of the young resistors, which for many of them was a real crisis. I mean, I know some who actually committed suicide because they couldn't deal with it. You know, here's this sense that we're doing something really courageous, but we're oppressors. How can we face that? And that was a good part of where the women's movement came from. The women's movement really didn't develop in a major force until the 70s, but was part of the root. The environmental movement was barely beginning. The civil rights movement, which is an interesting story, as long as the civil rights movement was focused on, you know, hideous sheriffs in Alabama, it was very popular in the North. Yeah. But by the mid-60s, it was shifting to the North. The last couple of years, Martin Luther King Day, you know, everybody celebrates Martin Luther King. What they celebrate is what he was doing in the South. By 1965, he was turning to organizing a poor people's movement, and that's all over the country. And in fact, when he was assassinated, it was at a time when he was in the midst of meeting the poor people's movement. Well, that's out of, kind of like gone too far. So when you read about Martin Luther King, they say, well, the last couple of years of his life, he kind of lost direction. So it's okay to be self-righteous about Alabama sheriffs, but not to look at what's happening in your neighborhood. It's the same thing. The civil rights movement was beginning to turn into a general movement of the poor. It was very frightening to power systems, but it was going on, and a lot of organizing was going on. There's a lot of craziness. You know. The youth culture was going on in its own way, just revolt, music, style of dress, all kinds of things. But the general effect was extraordinary. I mean, and it's lasting. And the whole country just changed, became just more civilized. Like my own university, MIT, when around 1960, say, MIT was white males, well-dressed, ties and jackets, obedient, deferential, did your homework, and so on. If you walk around MIT today, it looks like this. Half women, literally, half women, third minorities, casual dress, informal. normal relationships, student serious work, more serious than before, but just totally different. And the same is true all over the country. So as far as, say, reaction goes, the, you know, educated elite sectors are very more rigid than they were, because they were frightened by all of this. There's a tremendous backlash against sort of neoliberal liberalism comes from everything else, all part of the backlash. But among the population, it's just expanded all over. I gave a talk in the Idaho-Washington border in a little town where all you see in the town is Christian evangelical posters and, you know, National Rifle Association and so on. You know, 4,000 people show up from nowhere, and it's around there somewhere. And that happens all over. I mean, I spend maybe an hour a night, I spend a lot of time answering email, but probably an hour a night is just turning down invitations, which I'd really like to accept. And there are very few people, unfortunately, who are publicly available. You know, it's not the kind of thing that privileged people do. We're all obviously very privileged, but they don't do it. You know, so there are very few people who will do these things, and they're just overwhelming demand, and they get the same reaction. I mean, you know, Howard Zinn, I'm sure, who is another one who's on the road all the time, though he's not young, he's older than I am, but he's out there all the time. and he's just a garage with invitations, and gets the same reaction, thousands of people showing up. But, you know, so it's just a tremendous change in the whole country. It just became a lot more civilized. And it, in a lot of very striking ways, which aren't discussed much, but they're very real. So take in the 1980s, if you take a look at what happened, it's quite striking. When Reagan came in 1981, he was facing a problem. He, you know, I don't know what was going on, but the guys around him were facing problems in Central America, which were very much like what Kennedy faced in South Vietnam in 1961, very similar. And they tried to follow the Kennedy model. You know, Kennedy was their hero, very much unlike the picture that's been created. They tried to follow in Central America the same model that Kennedy did in South Vietnam. You can see it step by step, same white papers, you know, communists are taking over, and the whole business. The media went along totally, you know, yeah, communists are taking over the world, they, and so on. But they had to back off. They had to back off because it was just too much popular opposition. And a lot of it was coming from the church, a lot from popular groups and so on. So they backed off and they carried out what they call the clandestine war. That's a war which means everybody knows about it except the American population. I mean, obviously the victims know, the participants know, and so on. But they keep it away from the population so they don't find out about it. I mean, it's called the name for it is called the Vietnam Syndrome. And there's an effort to present it as if Americans don't want to face casualties. It's a total lie. It had nothing to do with Americans facing casualties. You know, if people, or if there's something they think of as like a just war, Second World War, you know, it doesn't matter how many casualties there are if you do it. What they don't want to face is aggressive war. But you can't say that, you know, you can't make that public. But there's a deep feeling that we don't want to be involved in an aggressive war. I mean, that's why they dropped the draft. The draft is a citizen's army. And they just can't get a citizen's army to fight colonial wars. That's something the British knew 200 years ago. You know, they didn't use British soldiers, they used mercenaries, French, everyone else. But the US dropped the citizen's army. And instead they have a mercenary army. It's called a volunteer army. But it's just a mercenary army of the disadvantaged. People like Lindy England, you know, the woman who was this Abu Ghraib thing. You just look at her background, you see where they're coming from. I mean, they're really oppressed people. No education, no opportunities, nothing. They, when they recruit for you know, soldiers, they don't go to Harvard Square. You know, they go downtown to the Boston slums, where you can pick up people who figure, okay, maybe I've got a way out of this. And those kind of people you can train to become, you know, trained killers. Or you just use plain mercenaries. They're called contractors or something like that. But they're just mercenaries, like the Foreign Legion. Or use special forces, like British special forces have been used as mercenaries all over the world. They're really good at kicking people in the face around here now. But that was part of it. By the time it got to the 80s, they couldn't carry out an invasion. So they used mercenary forces from Taiwan, Britain, Israel, other places, funding from Saudi Arabia. We're just organized mercenary army in Nicaragua, El Salvador, state security forces. And they did carry out a pretty hideous massacre, but it was nothing like an invasion. You know, that's not B-52s.
You're getting signal for time.
Okay, well, last comment about this, because it's quite important to not discuss. Something completely new happened in the 1980s, new in hundreds of years of Western imperialism. There was a solidarity movement in which people actually went to live with the victims. And that's never happened. You know, nobody thought to go live in a Vietnamese village during the Vietnam War. Nobody from France went to live in an Algerian village. It was considered very heroic if you wrote an article in Le Monde saying, you know, I don't like torture or something. Then you're a big hero, so on and so forth. But in the 1980s, literally tens of thousands of Americans went to Central America. A lot of them stayed there, my daughter, for example. But and they were mostly coming from the mainstream. One of the reasons why it's unknown is it was not happening in the elite centers. Like, it wasn't happening in Cambridge. It was happening in churches in Kansas, and, you know, Arizona, places like that. A lot of it was coming out of the Christian evangelical. And the very serious, sincere people, very dedicated, they're just coming out of a much more civilized country. And when it gets to the global justice movement, you know, it's just something totally new. There ain't like it anywhere, you know, all over the world. So yes, there have been a lot of changes, very positive ones. I mean, you know, they're not going to be given headlines in the newspapers, of course, but they're happening. So you've never seen a group like this. Not 40 years ago, even 20 years ago. And now you're seeing all over the place. You know, I was up in Carol and my wife were up in northeast Brazil, in the Amazon, 6-7 years ago, I forget. And I was giving various talks, but an anarchist group asked me to come talk in northeast Brazil, in the Amazon.
Although we would really love to talk for hours on these subjects, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule. And Mr. Hugh and Carol, some Irish whiskey.
Oh, fantastic.